Chapter 3. Italy rode down from Grasse in late evening of the last day of June. Tired, on a tired horse, he rode through the drab fields of burdock, shards, shacks, tramps, sour earth, and into the long streets of the Trasfuive, and crossed Old Bridge under the statue of St. Christopher of the Wayfarers, remembering the morning of the autumn equinox 3 years ago. He put up at a small inn just off Molson Boulevard, ordered dinner, and went to bed very soon after he'd eaten. He would look up his friends, take up his life tomorrow. Tonight he wanted only to sleep. The room was small, and with the curtains drawn, very dark. He got up again at once and drew back the curtains, opened both the windows wide to the warm, noisy city night. He'd almost fallen asleep when the bell of the cathedral, a few streets away, struck 10. After that, he lay wide awake in the darkness, suffering all the memories and presences of his time in Krasnoye, from the moment when he'd first heard that bell strike. The 2 years in which so much life had been compressed, they seemed to lie like a fiery bar of sunlight between the remote, long, quiet years in the shadow of the mountains and the unimaginable but immediate past, the 27 months of darkness. As he breakfasted in the hot morning at a street cafe in the river quarter, he debated going back to the inn, lying low for another day. He had not got much rest. He mistrusted himself, his energy, his strength. What would he have to face here? Riding from the Sovena, he had been very nervous at first, avoiding every town entry and possible checkpoint that he could avoid, dreading the request to show his papers. That dread had lessened, as he was, at one point and then another, checked cursorily and passed. But what was the situation here? He did not really know, and was apprehensive. However, he had to take Louisa's horse to the Parodesca stables in Roche Street. And he was going to have to get some money. He could not afford another night at the inn. Emmanuel had loaned him 50 kroner, of which he had 16 left in his pocket. Less than he had arrived with the first time, 5 years ago. Less all round, he thought, coming back down from Old Quarter to the river and walking up the boulevard under the trees by the bright water. Less cash, less strength, less time to live. Less of a man to stand up against the storming of the human world and the universe at his mind and body. The storm of light and wind and sensation and passion that never ceased, never rested, until death. For the walls of a building, a prison, were dust in that storm. He felt peculiarly slight, light, insubstantial, as he walked up the wide street by the river, a flickering thing, exposed, uncertain. This mote, this speck between the sun in its gulfs of light and the earth with its long shadow. This was himself, Itale Sode, and he was supposed to withstand the entire universe in order to remain himself. Not only that, to do his job, to be part of it. It was a strange business to be a man walking in the sunlight, stranger than to be a stone or a river or a tree holding its branches in the July heat. They all knew what they were doing. He did not. He passed two little girls hurrying with their hard-breathing nurse towards the far mirage of a sherbet vendor's cart. He saw their pigtails bob on their thin shoulders. How long since he had seen a child? He had reached the office of Novesma Verba. He turned to the parapet and leaned his hands on it, watching the bright Molson go towards the sea. So far to go from this inland country. My shoreless kingdom, Amadei had called it in the ode. So far to go for a bitter end and nameless. Come on, he said to himself. Come on, Itali. And straightened up, turned, crossed the street, went up the stairs to the journal's office. In his determination, and out of old habit, he did not knock but went straight in. A young fellow stepped out in front of him from behind the table. What do you want? Who's here? Itali said, stammering, unnerved. He did not know whether he had forgotten this man or never known him. Mr. Brelave is busy with a visitor. I'm Vernoy. He was young, 20 at most, and shone with self-confidence. Itali, vulnerable at every impression, was impressed by that youthfulness, and casting about for something to say, asked, Are you from Amictia? Then he remembered that the student society had been put under ban and several of its leaders at the university in Krasnoy arrested a few months before his release. It was a very stupid question, and the boy rapped out, Who are you? Sorde. Itali Sorde. Sorry, I wanted... You're Sorde? Itali said yes, he was. Vernoy fell to pieces like wet paper, waved his hands, ran for Brelave. Brelave came, carrying his dark face like a long, ironical signboard on top of his long body. Exactly the same, unchanged, so that Itali laughed with pure joy at the sight of him. But his friend, embracing him, sobbed and would not let him go. Here, come on, Thomas. They could not look at each other. Come on. Wait. Here it is. Brelave found his handkerchief and blew his nose. Almighty Christ, Itali, he said tenderly. What did you have? Have? What were you ill with? Typhus. No joke, eh? Not a very good one. Here, come along. Why are we standing around my handkerchief like a scene from Othello? San Giusto's in here. Remember him, Itali? Almighty Christ, say your name again. Where are you staying? I didn't try to write you in the Sovena. Your baroness said better not to when she wrote. Has to watch her reputation, political, of course. She kept you hidden there long enough. I expect you needed it. He had his arm around Itali's shoulders and was steering him into the composing room, where, considerably shaken by his own feelings and Brelave's, Itali found himself returning a handshake and looking into a face that completed his confusion by bringing around him the moonlight, the sound of fountains, Louisa's voice, Piera's voice, the carriages on Fontamana Street. When all that subsided, he was sitting down, feeling a little sick, and the others were around him, looking concerned. Sorry, I'm still shaky. How are you, San Giusto? Very well, Sordi. You're staying in Krasnoy? Yes, since 2 weeks. I'm tired of England. I come here, said the Italian. He spoke mostly in the present tense. His voice was calm, his manner relaxed, and in his smile there was a hint of complicity. Itali felt at ease with him at once. But it's not the same mood here as in 27, even in Aesna. It's agitated, bad-tempered. But who knows? I come from England. Everyone on the continent is agitated and emotional, huh? What about Paris? Breleve asked. Oh, well, Paris. The ultras. Royer Collard. Article 14, lovers, chestnut trees, old men catching little fishes in the Seine. Paris is always the same. And who can predict of her? They laughed. And again, Sangiusto shot a quick accomplice's glance at Itali. With some sense of playing a role, Itali asked the questions Breleve had a right to expect him to ask, about recent events, political trends and changes. If there's any change, Breleve said, it's a change of mood, as Sangiusto said, underneath, in people, in the people, on top, nothing. The ministry is the same, except for Raskineska replacing Tarven. The assembly mumbles on. The Grand Duchess is ill, maybe not ill, maybe all rumour. But 3 years ago, there were no rumours, said Sangiusto. Taxes were heavier, Breleve went on. Political arrests increasingly common. Administrative sentences without trial or term had been introduced. The Student Society and several other groups had been put under ban. Censorship was massive, and all mail likely to be read. There had been two bad harvests, and unemployment in the cities of the East and Centre was high. Some cause for bad temper, Itali said. They blame it all on the Assembly, even the bad harvest. Your Assembly is the expiatory, what do you call it, the scapegoat for Austria. The Prime Minister sees to that. How's Aragon been doing? Itali asked. Damn Aragon, Breleve said. He's not our Danton, Itali. He's our Talleyrand, a demagogic one. The shit's in a wooden shoe instead of a silk stocking. The nation be hanged if Stefan Aragon can climb a little higher on the gallows. Louisa said that my pardon was largely due to him. It was. He needs our good press, and you were the price he had to pay for it. Well, how is Frenin? Fine. He's in Solaragi. For the paper? Living there. In Solaragi? What's going on there? Well, what always did. Students, cattle fairs, everybody asleep by nine. He's a grain shipper. Doing well, I hear. He left Krasnoy a few weeks after we heard you'd been arrested. Itali still looked blank. He got cold feet, Breleve said gently. Breleve, Frenin, Itali had been friends long before they thought of coming to the capital. And it had been Frenin who brought them. Frenin who said, how long ago, in the park, by the blue Molson in the sunlight, I'm thinking of Krasnoy. It was an old bitterness to Breleve, to Itali, a blow. He could not escape the conviction that to have suffered, to have submitted to evil, though he'd had no way at all to refuse it, had made him a cause of evil. It was because of him that Frenin had given up. In the conscious and painful acceptance of this responsibility, he sat silent for a minute. He weighed a broken inkstand that was on the table in his hand and said finally, Thomas, do you know anything about Isabel? Absolutely no trace, nothing. They denied consistently from the beginning that he was in St. Lazare. Claimed he'd been released with an order to get out of the province. Beyond that, nothing. He had lived with the boy's death for 2 years in prison. He had not known, till the hope was taken from him, how much hope he had kept hidden, that when he came out, he would find it had been a mistake, a cruel hoax, a nightmare of his own, and Isabeau was alive. This also, this inescapably, was his responsibility. He was answerable for this death. Brélavé asked him nothing, saying that he was distressed and assuming that he knew even less than they about what had become of the boy. San Giusto stood up, stretching, and said in English, "To fresh fields and pastures new. I have eaten nothing." "Come on, I told Giovanna I'd meet him at the Illyrica at one," Brélavé said, relieved to get away from the unlucky subject. Giovan Carante had not changed. He was dark and warm as a banked fire. They sat 2 hours over their coffee cups, talking. Two or three young men came up and asked if they might be introduced to Mr. Sode. Itali shook their hands and was short with them. They went humbly away. "You're their hero. Their Valtura, dear fellow," said Carante.
"God forbid."
"God forbid indeed," Brélavé said. "Valtura's dead. Died in the Spielberg in 28. "Where Silvio Palico, who knew Byron, is now," said San Giusto in his calm voice. "There must be good company in the Spielberg prison." Now Itali knew why San Giusto looked at him as if there was a tacit bond between them. There was. San Giusto had spent 3 years in the Piombi in Venice as a political prisoner. Brélavé, Carante, the young men wanted to hear and dared not ask about his jail term. San Giusto did not want to hear, did not need to ask. Foreigner, exile, he was Itali's compatriot. Arguments concerning Stefan Aragon surfaced occasionally, and in the course of one of them, San Giusto put in, "But he's a professional, isn't he? And you are amateurs, myself too. The coup d'etat are made by professionals, they succeed. The revolutions are made by amateurs." "And fail?" Brélavé inquired. "Of course." "But listen, San Giusto," Carante said. "The words are good. It was amateurs that made 89 all right. The crowds, the people, they walked to Versailles and took the Bastille. And the Assembly, the Girondins, the Jacobins, they were lawyers, provincial men of letters, not politicians. But as they learned their trade, as they became professional, the revolution began to fail, to lead inevitably towards the coup d'etat that betrayed it." "They did never learn their trade," the Italian said. "Robespierre is always an amateur. The professional is Napoleon. The question is really this: what is failure, and what is success? The revolution failed, yes, and Napoleon is a very successful man, a conqueror, an emperor. But it was the failure, not the success, that gives hope to our life. Vivre libre ou mourir," Itali said, and laughed. "Exactly. Venio, a professional lawyer, very successful in his profession. A nice, lazy fellow. An amateur deputy. Unsuccessful."
"Skark!"
San Giusto cut his throat with the side of his hand. A fine career cut short. "But first, he told us to live free or die. Why did you laugh, Sode?" "Found I'd rather stay alive, even if not free. Of course, for 2 years, 3 years or longer. But here we are now, alive and free." "Alive," Itali said. His money problem had been promptly solved, as Brélavé told him peremptorily that he had 28 months' wages waiting and a vesma verba. "It's been very useful. The most cash we ever kept on hand. I don't know how many loans we've made from it to get people over a thin time." But they always repaid, because it was your money. If it was my money, or our money, they'd have embezzled freely. Carante had asked him to come share his rooms. He hesitated. A friend was keeping my old rooms for me when I went to Rakava. I should go see whether he's there. Carante went with him into the river quarter, past St. Stephen's and the street of Hangman's Feast, the swarming courts and alleys under toppling houses in the shadow of the hill of the university. No change here, Itali remarked. Not for 500 years, said Carante. At number 9, Malanestrada, Mrs. Rosa, cat beleaguered, greeted her long-lost tenant without warmth. Your things are here, Mr. Sori. I'll be glad to have them out my way. Is Mr. Brunoy here? She looked him up and down. No. She knew him to be a jailbird, but his voice and clothing said gentleman. She wanted him to be a gentleman. She'd had enough of jailbirds in her life. But she could not trust him. He had let her down, and her voice was vindictive as she said, "He died here 2 years ago. Kunes got the room." I see, Itali said. After a moment, he asked submissively if Kune was in. Mrs. Rosa stood aside, and he and Carante climbed the dark, rickety stairs. Kune came from behind his loom. We was very sorry to hear, Mr. Sordi, he said. It's good to see you. Itali shook his hand and stopped to play with the baby, not born when he left, and now a solemn 2-year-old. The delicate face, the dark eyes gazed into Itali's. What's her name, Kune? It's a him. He's on the small side, makes him look like a girl. We call him Livia. There's a couple of things I kept for you here. Kune rummaged in the other room and returned with a small packet of papers which he gave to Itali. Several letters written from Malafrena in the autumn of 1827, and a scrap of paper, one downhill scrawl of barely readable writing on it. Prometheus, no chains eternal. Mr. Brunoy wrote that for you a day or two before he died, Kune said. Itali gave it to Carante and walked away to the window. Did you know him, Jivan? He asked. Not well. He used to come to the office for a word of you. Itali stood with his back turned. He was an upright man. That he was, said the weaver, and a good death. He couldn't talk when he wrote you that, but in the end he spoke. He raised up and said, I'm ready, like a bridegroom going to his wedding. I looked to see who he's talking to. And he lay back quiet and content, and his breath caught like, and he died. I wished the priest had stayed. I never saw a better death. Aye, Itali said. It was what he knew how to do. He took the slip of paper back from Carante and slipped it folded into the back of his watch. How does it go, Kune? I've kept working. He looked up at Itali. We're in your rooms now. There being 6 of us, we spread out a bit, but if you want... No. I won't be coming back, Kune. Did she raise the rent on you? No. And she didn't ask rent of Mr. Brunoy at the end, so that the little he'd put by for it and the books and his watch paid to bury him. She's all right. Knows when times are hard. Kneeling, Itali put out his hand to the frail, solemn little boy in his sexless, shapeless, worn dress. "Goodbye, Livia," he said. The contrast in size of their hands was too much. He touched the child's cheek. He stood up, shook hands with Kune, bidding him goodbye. They went on to Karante's rooms, south of the Elena Prada. Karante had kept a letter for Itali from Amadei Estenska, dated the 6th of February, 1828. Itali began to read it, laid it down, and put his head in his hands. "I can't read any more letters from the dead," he said. Karante had the top floor of a house, a set of big rooms, sparsely furnished, with high, large windows. Itali paced down the uncarpeted floor and back, and sat down again wearily. "They all died today," he said. "They haven't been very good years, these last two or three," Karante said gently. "What's wrong? What is it that's wrong, Jivan?" "I don't know. Speaking for myself, nothing. I go on writing. It's all I care about. You know, really, I make a living by it. I'm going to get married in September." "Married? To Carola?" Karante nodded. He had been in love a long time, and had never been willing to talk about it. Itali could not tell even now whether his reticence expressed coolness of feeling or suppressed a happiness he felt egotistical and unseemly. "So as I say, I have all I asked for myself. But for all of us together, they haven't been good years. You in jail, Amadei dead, Frenin giving up. Who can blame him? We knew all along we were pounding our heads on a stone wall, trying to knock it down. But one's head gets sore and addled. And there have been so many searches and summons. Thomas has been called up 3 times now. And these damnable administrative sentences, they've frightened us all. And the censorship's so heavy, I wonder why anybody still bothers to read Verba. Sometimes, but they do read it. Our subscription list has doubled in the last year and a half. And there are young men coming up, and men like San Giusto. There are more of us than there used to be. It's only that the waiting's long. And we've never known for certain what it is we're waiting for. No change there. But we're a couple of years older." Itali smiled. The kind sobriety of Karante's temper refreshed him now as always. "Waiting," he said. "That's not true of you, Jivan. You have your work. But I've never worked. I've only made ready. The time will come, Itali. Will it? Is there any time but now?" Karante did not answer. "I don't know, Jivan. I have lost. I have no right to speak of this." "You have earned the right to speak of anything." "No. That's exactly it. I have earned nothing. Nothing. You don't learn. You don't gain where I was, Jivan. You lose. You lose the right to talk to people who believe in the powers of light. What I learned there was that I have no rights and infinite responsibility." "That would be infinite injustice. It's false, Itali." "I would rather trust you than myself," Itali said. "I wish I could. I was a better man before..." He cut himself off, standing up abruptly. "I'm very tired. Maybe I should lie down for a while." He went off to the spare room. At 8, Karante looked in to go out to supper with him. He was sound asleep, and Carente hesitated to wake him. He looked down at Itali's face, worn and sleep-submerged. And then, out the uncurtained open window, westward, over roofs and gables and chimney stacks, the high view smoky and shadowed in long evening light. It was hot. There was no wind. Carente stood there beside the friend he had not hoped to see again, wishing that there would be a wind off the river, darkness, rain. But the weather was steady. It would not change. On the bureau, a silver watch lay open. It said 2:30. Carente tapped it, but it did not run. He spoke to Itali at last, rousing him, and they went down to the inn where Carente took his meals. July passed. A long, hot July. And August came in hot. Itali was still with Carente. The novelist had pressed him to stay, and he'd yielded easily, lacking any real wish to go out and find himself a room. The impermanence of the arrangement, Carente's affectionate, reserved companionship, suited him. Companionship, friendship, he wanted very much. But he could not take hold here. He could not recommit himself to anything but his friends. He waited, irresolute, drifting, and increasingly tense, though his health continued to improve. Taking comfort in being with Carente, Brelave, San Giusto, and the others. Waiting for alternate Mondays, when the mail from the Montena diligence came in. Waiting to decide where he was going to stay in Krasnoy, and whether he was going to stay in Krasnoy. Waiting. He did not know for what. George Haleska was travelling in Germany, not due back for a few weeks. Itali had gone to pay his respects to the old count, and had been received with emotion that was painful to him. The tough old man was over 80 now, and his invitation was pleading. You could stay here, you know. I've lost count of the rooms standing empty. He asked about Louisa, and even mentioned Estenska, whom he'd never liked. A bit of real fireworks, that lad. One fine burst and it was over. He had the sense to know it, and not go on sputtering for 50 years boring the cosmos. I wonder if most of us don't bore the cosmos, Itali said to Carente, as they strolled back through the Elena Prada in the fag end of the warm evening. It's my profession, said the novelist. Anyhow, I'd rather bore it than be bored by it. A man, in what had been a respectable coat, came up to them begging. Itali talked with him a while. There's a new trade for him, he said, and the man had gone off with their small joint contribution. How many out of work now? One of every 3 or 4, I should think. Vernoy says the river docks are working less than half the men this summer. So is the assembly, Itali said, with a glance at the Sinalio Palace, looming pale and somber behind the splendid chestnut alleys. I wonder why the Grand Duchess has shut herself up in the Rook. Afraid of demonstrations, Aragon says. The Sinalia is more vulnerable. I wonder what it is she really fears. Damned Austrian cow in the throne room of Aegon the Great. She needs to be taught her place. Carente laughed. You're fierce lately. So's everyone else. It's hot. We're tired. My God, we're tired. Will it ever change? I came here 5 years ago. All that time. All my life, all our lives, Jivan, since we were born. The net's been drawing tighter. The air's been getting staler. There's been less and less room to move. Europe is like a pond in drought, drying up. And the Austrian cattle drinking the last of the water, said Carante. They walked on. An owl flew across the path in front of them, from one oak to another, hunting, soft as a tossed ball of dark wool in the dusk. Abrilave, who had taken over Itali's editorship of Novesma Verba, wanted to give it back to him. But Itali had temporized, and most of the others agreed with him that they had to be cautious. He was, after all, a convicted seditionist, and any public act put both himself and his collaborators at risk. He had drawn enough to live on out of the fund that Brelave insisted was his back wages, but was not currently on the staff. He served, however, as an unpaid employee, along with San Giusto, who was working as a very slightly paid reporter at the Assembly. Their reportership was more than anything else a test, to find if they could, with impunity, reconnect themselves with the journal. So the two of them sat in the gallery of the Assembly room in the hot afternoons, listening to the order of the day dragging on in Latin. Below them, among the scanty ranks of the Estates General. No other reporters even bothered to attend. The Courier Mercury got its list of motions direct from the President. San Giusto and Itali allayed their boredom one afternoon by inventing the debates in the Egyptian National Dynastic Assembly of both kingdoms on the 11th of August 1830 BC. The President, I recognize Mr. Afasis, the deputy from Karnak. Mr. Afasis, my lords, gentlemen, are we to credit the unsupported allegation of the honorable deputy from Petou upon Nile that two wagon loads of perishable produce, such as pullet eggs and radishes, and a small cart containing mummified cats, were detained for 62 hours for examination at the west gate of His Divine Highness's capital city? Is it positively known, can it be subject to material proof, that the pullet eggs and radishes were rendered unfit for consumption, and that the mummified cats deteriorated in quality due to the alleged detention for examination? Brelave slipped their farce into Novesma Verba, signing it Cheops, and the censor passed it. It was the journal's last report of debates in the Assembly. At the opening next day, Prime Minister Cornelius appeared on the rostrum to request adjournment of the Assembly until October on the part of the Grand Duchess Maria, whose indisposition, aggravated by the inclement weather, forbade her the study and exercise of judgment required for the sanction or veto of decrees voted by the Assembly convened by her gracious favour. The President, a right-wing noble, closed debate and adjourned the session. And as protest began from the left, a concerted exit by the right took enough deputies out that the protesters lacked the quorum of 70. It all took 6 or 8 minutes. Itali and San Giusto had to compare notes to be sure they knew what had occurred. They went off at once to the Café Illyrica with the news, but it had preceded them. Men out of work wanted nothing better than a subject of talk, a subject of indignation. The closure of the Parliament, to which nobody had paid any attention, drew the attention of the whole city. Itali and San Giusto, themselves out of work again, wandered the hot, restless streets, watching and listening. The park was full of people, as if it were some festival day. The city watch had been posted at the gates of the Senalia Palace, empty now at the end of its long, chestnut-shaded mall. The palace guard was on duty at the Rook, which stood tawny and dour over its square, baking in the August sun. Shops along Palaise Street, between the two palaces, were mostly closed and shuttered as if for holiday. Molson Boulevard lay long and empty above the empty river. One barge came down, black in the blinding sun glare, as Itale and San Giusto strolled to the journal's office. Aragon was there, fresh from court. All doors there, he said, were locked, all mouths shut. Only one rumour was afloat, that a courier had arrived last night from Vienna. But couriers were always arriving. "The Emperor's dead," said young Verneuil. "Almighty Christ," said Brelavé. "It's Metternich that's dead." "Impossible," said San Giusto. "Metternich lives forever. Is the Grand Duchess perhaps really sick?" Aragon, sitting sideways on the long composing table, his coat off and his stock loosened, shook his big, rough head. "No sicker than yesterday. She was at Mass this morning in Rook Chapel. Cancer she may have, but that won't explain today's move." His voice, with its slurring eastern accent, dominated all others. And though he looked hot and baffled, he was enjoying his power to dominate, to give answers, to force the respect of these self-willed journalists who had lost confidence in him. He turned now, as always, instinctively, turned to the man in whom he sensed authority or symbolic value for the group, and spoke to him as deep unto deep. "What's the mood in the streets now, Sode?" "Do I know?" Aragon's knowingness jarred on Itali. "The same as the mood in here, I suppose. We're all in the same boat." "It's the unemployed mobs they're afraid of," said young Verneuil, with his sententious and irresistible self-assurance. "They've closed the assembly because it's a potential rallying centre." "Rallying about what?" said Brelavé. "Why the hugger-muggering in the Rook? Why have all the ostriches put their heads in the sand?" "Well, Verneuil must be right," Carante said. "But why so abruptly? They've created the disturbance they were trying to avoid. It's not like Cornelius. His reasons must be pressing." The discussion went round and round. Moved on to the Illyrica. Went on. Got nowhere. Words and men came and went. It was 9 o'clock. Itali's head ached. He sat gazing at his glass of beer, the drift of foam at the rim. He picked it up and drank it off. And as he set it down, saw Aragon making his way among the tables to him. The deputy bent down and said in a low voice, "Come out here a moment, Sode. What's up? I want a word with you." He took Itali's arm and led him across Tiponti Street. But he could not wait till they had got across the street into the park to speak. In the midst of passing traffic, in the dusty darkness broken by cab lanterns, he said aloud, his face close to Itali's, "There's been a revolution in France. King Charles is dethroned. He went too far, violated the charter. The city wouldn't take it. They fought in the streets. The Duke of Bordeaux will be made constitutional king." They stood still amongst the horses, the rolling wheels. Is that it, then? That's it. Charles tried to dissolve the Chamber of Deputies, overshot his authority. He abdicated on the 30th of July. The fighting must have been over for 12 days now. The new king will be sworn to fealty to the Constitution. It's the end of absolute monarchy in France. The end, Itare repeated. The flashing darkness and noise of the traffic, the smell of dust and horse sweat and hot stone, it was familiar. He knew these words, this moment. And the beginning. Where did you find out? A friend in Vienna, through a friend in Eisenach. You and I are among the dozen or so people in the whole country that know it. Itali was struck by Aragon's evident satisfaction as he said this, mixed with a kind of urgent confusion. Still gripping Itali's arm, the deputy went on, "What do we do with it? What do we do with it? It's a bombshell. Cornelius knows that. What do we do with it, Sordi?" "Throw it. Let everybody know. That's what they're afraid of, isn't it? You announce it at the Illyrica. I'll get some fellows to print up something for the provinces." Itali laughed as he spoke. He felt that the moment was much too large for him. The noise of hooves and wheels on cobblestones was the only convincing part of it. He and the rest of them were suddenly playing a role in history. And for this reason, he felt artificial, like any private man up on a stage. At the same time, it was at last easy to make decisions. The time had come. All one had to do at such a moment, when the walls fell down, was go ahead in the direction one had always tried to go. Aragon was flustered and two-minded, only because he never had any one direction to his actions, any fidelity. Enormously ambitious, energetic, emotional, he lacked the necessary passion. But he was very quick. He caught Itali's meaning at once, and wanted no more from him, having received his impetus. "All right, good. Here's the note from Vienna with the details. Go to the press as fast as you can before they close in on us. I'll let the city know." As Itali, Carante, and San Giusto left the Illyrica together, they heard Aragon, up on one of the sidewalk tables, telling the news in his big, slurring voice. "The French Revolution is accomplished. They've got the freedom they fought for 40 years ago. The last Bastille is fallen, and their chance is ours. The same choice, the same chance. Is this France's victory and glory, or Europe's, ours? Will we sit quiet and let Metternich send more troops here to keep us quiet and suck us dry? I say, recall the National Assembly, and Slovenska to the throne of the free kingdom." The traffic seemed to have halted. Cab lamps and cafe lanterns shining on many faces upturned to the orator. All things moveless, as things seen in a flash of lightning. The three men slipped away, hurried down dark streets towards the river.